I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
I'm with Michelle, who I think a lot of you will know, is the author of several books, including Valencia and Black Wave, which blur the line between novel and memoir. You know, I think there's something quite interesting about that line. Novels are allowed to be as near as damn it to real life and the author's own experiences. Indeed, there are some authors who have been very insistent that novels should only be drawn from the author's own experiences, others who feel that they should be pure invention. I think most other authors of novels sit somewhere between those two poles. Memoir, of course, is something that is supposed to be strictly drawn from the author's own life, and that places a real set of constraints on what you should do with memoir. I won't say can do with memoir, because lots of people have either played with that rule or broken it in lots of different ways. And I think Michelle is somebody who has written or published novels, and now this volume against memoir. I wondered if you would like to start us off by talking about the title of this collection and the title essay.
Well, I thought it was a cheeky title, so I thought that would be good. But the memoir, the piece against memoir, I wrote actually to be delivered as a lecture at the Tin House Writers Workshop in the States. And I was there a few years ago teaching a memoir workshop. And if you're there as an instructor, you also have to deliver a lecture. So all week I was teaching how to write a memoir and like empowering people to write a memoir. And then I thought I would just tear it all down and talk about how hard it is to write memoir. I just had so much to say about it after having written a few and read from it for many years. And I just had a lot to say about the way that it cements your understanding of your own life in this way that becomes very fixed because you've written it down and you're reading from it. And so you think you know your own story, and it can prevent you, I think, from growing in a particular way and looking back and changing your mind about what happened. So I thought that was, I kind of wanted to explore that. I wanted to explore the idea that memoir writing, the similarities it has to addiction. I'm a sober addict, and there's so much about the compulsion, how it feels like a compulsion to write personal narrative, and it feels very linked to the other things that are compulsive about me. And I read this wonderful book called The Midnight Disease by it's in the book, I can't remember her name, who wrote it. She's a Harvard neurobiologist who sustained a trauma. She had a miscarriage and became hypergraphic, where suddenly she had this like full body craving to just be writing constantly about her life and her experience. And it really made me think differently about my own writing, because I did start writing in earnest on the heels of a lot of trauma, and I really wanted to write about my own life. And I'm like, just thinking about the whole memoir, my relationship with memoir being like, is it an addiction? Is it mental illness? Like, what, you know, is it an art form? And I think that people who make any kind of art, I think it's very mysterious where the inspiration or the drive comes from. So it was kind of fun to play with those things, you know?
Yeah, I mean, something I really picked up on in the title essay is a few sentences near the end of the essay, where you write about saying, you know, if you wrote Valencia now, which I think you published in, when did you publish Valencia?
It was published, I think, in like 2000, but I wrote it in real time when I was 25, so it took a while to come out.
So you talk about saying that if you wrote it now, I think the now of this text is
2016.
Yeah,
I think,
so yeah. If you wrote it now, it'd be a totally different book, because mm-hmm. everything is totally different. Mm-hmm. You say that memoir picks up the essence of the moment you wrote it, where you were sitting, the quality of the sun, the amount of car exhaust or freshness in the air, the quality of your heart, it being open or not, how close its most recent breakage, how you are regarding your family of origin. Is it a they did the best they could week, or a your best was not fucking good enough week? And yeah, I was really taken with that passage. So I wonder if you'd like to maybe expand on that a bit.
It's like you're sitting down to sort of say the final word on your own experience, but the you're not really paying attention. Or I felt like I wasn't very conscious of, and I don't know if it makes a difference to be conscious of it or not, but I wasn't very conscious of how much, like, my mood would affect, you know, like, my take on my own experience at that moment. And then what was my mood being impacted by? So, you know, that there's, even though I wrote everything down, I liked the challenge of and the parameters of memoir being like, you're going to tell the truth, that you're going to get as close to the truth as you can, and that's your job. I liked that, but, you know, it's like, well, the truth according to what moment? You know, it's like, your opinion about your own life can fluctuate, your opinion about the people in your life can fluctuate, but you're capturing it just in that moment, and you're sealing it forever. And in the piece, I just go on to talk also about, I've, like, dabbled in Buddhism, and there's this whole thing that, like, in Buddhism, you drop the storyline. You drop the stories, you stop telling yourself. And I'm just like, oh my God, writing memoirs is like the least Buddhist thing you can do. All you're doing is repeating the story of your life, and there is no you. So like, what the fuck is even, what are you doing, you know? So I just was grappling with all these ideas about memoir and how strange, and what a strange occupation it really is. But at the end of it, how much I just am compelled to do it. And I do love it. And I feel like that's the drive that I came with. And so I want to... honored what the goddess gave me. I'm going to keep doing it. But it is strange, you know, and you do have to look at whatever. And I also look at sort of the wreckage that it brings along a little bit too, that you are writing about other people get implicated in your story. You know, even if you try to be ethical about it and kind and not write from a place of vindictiveness, like inevitably you fuck up or you are being vindictive or whatever, you know. And so I kind of call myself out on that a little bit. And it, again, that was another part that made me think about its connection to addiction, because, you know, I got sober in like a 12-step program. And when you do that, you sort of look back and you take stock of what you did and who you hurt and you try to apologize. And I'm like, oh, what, I have to do that? Like, look back and, you know, and it's like, I don't like that it's hurt people, but I also feel pretty strident about I was telling my story, you know. Yeah, it's complicated.
From a queer perspective, I think this is very interesting because, you know, certainly my experience, that of a lot of queer writers I know, there is, I think, some pressure from publishers, from journalistic, from broadcast outlets and so forth, to write autobiographically, this sort of mm-hmm. sense that, you know, people are not necessarily interested in our wider community politics. What they want is these kind of personal stories. And, you know, what I've tried to do with that format and what you've done, I think, in a lot of the essays in this book, both the more directly autobiographical ones and the more wide-ranging ones, is draw upon kind of wider histories of queer movements, queer culture, how those things have impacted on you, but also, yeah, broaden out into a wider queer history. Do you feel, you know, memoir autobiographical writing can be a useful sort of Trojan horse to get our wider histories and cultures to an audience that might not seek them out?
I love being able to do that. I mean, I don't, you know, the conclusions that I've come to and the analysis that I've reached and the inspirations that I've taken and come from my community. So it's like to write a memoir and leave that out, it would make it seem like I was like self-invented or self-created, and I'm not, you know, I'm like created on the shoulders of everyone who came before me. You know, I think that there's a, and I love how you do that in Trans. I was like, I was already just so enjoying your story. And then when you brought in all of the history, I was like, this is so cool. I think that there's a lot of pressure for all writers actually to write memoir. I think that the culture wants memoir. I think that that's why we had that horrible James Frey debacle a million years ago, right? That nobody would buy.
Well, the film of that's just coming out.
It is? Are you kidding
me? So we might, well, I might want to explain.
Oh,
James
God,
Frey.
Brother.
James Frey wrote a book in the early 2000s called A Million Little Pieces,
yeah.
I think it was called. Mm-hmm. And it seems like a lot of people are familiar with this story, but I've just written about it on my PhD, so I don't want that to just sit in a drawer. So, you know, he went on Oprah Winfrey, but basically his agent said he was trying to sell it as a novel. His agent said to him, like, no one was buying it. And his agent said, why don't you sell it as memoir? We're more likely to sell it. So he did. And then, of course, he took the flak when, you know, in the early age of the internet, turns out there are people on the internet who will spend huge amounts of time going through your narrative and checking whether or not it stands up. And it didn't. And, you know, Frey had to sort of issue, you know, Frey had been on Oprah Winfrey and she'd been saying what a great memoir it was. And he was like, yes, it is. Thank you. And then it turned out it wasn't, and he had to go on again and apologise. His publisher started offering refunds to anyone who could prove purchase and felt deceived by the way this book had been sold.
How about just anyone who just thought it was crap? No.
It turns out they don't do refunds if you just bought a book and you just thought it was bad. But unfortunately. You know, there was that, and of course there was the J.T. Leroy case, I guess, around about the same time with J.T. Leroy's novel Sarah, which is all about this kind of ambiguously gendered, supposedly trans sex worker.
She piled everything on. Sex worker, HIV positive, heroin
addict,
homeless. Yeah,
a friend
addict,
of mine once
homeless.
Described it as catnip for counterculture. And, you know, the sort of state of understanding of LGBT culture at the time in the late 90s was that, you know, both Leroy themselves as an author and the character in Sarah could be sort of gay one minute and a transsexual woman the next, and people were like, yeah, that's fine. And, you know, of course, like, these were sold as autobiographical novels, but, you know, because J.T. Leroy was being written by a late 30s punk called Laura Albert, and wasn't this 17-year-old sex worker that had apparently written these novels, J.T. Leroy wouldn't appear in public until Albert came up with the idea of putting their cousin in a blonde wig and sunglasses and speaking with a sort of Michael Jackson sort of voice. And this somehow managed to work for 5 years. It's extraordinary.
It is such an interesting story.
I mean, yeah, we did an event with a screening of Author, the J.T. Leroy story, a few years ago here, and I recommend watching that. But these are sort of interesting ways in which these sort of novel and memoir boundaries have got blurred, largely due to commercial pressures. Again, you know, Laura Albert tried to sell Sarah under their own name, and publishers were saying, no, you're not a marketable author. So Albert was like, I'll give you a fucking marketable author. Here you go. Mm. And, you know, I've got some sympathy with that. Yeah, you know, the problem is the industry, right? But yeah, I mean, you know, so I'm intrigued to hear, you know, what you think of those pressures on people to write memoir. Do you think it's just that people maybe don't believe fiction anymore?
I don't know what it is. It's so strange to me. I think a good story is a good story, but I think that there is maybe something about the aspirational aspect of a memoir that, you know, you can take some sort of like comfort or inspiration from somebody's story. I think that as humans, we really like to hear each other's stories. You know I really do. I do love memoirs, but I love fiction also. So I don't understand why there's such a divide. And also I understand how much of real life is hidden in fiction, you know, and how much within a memoir can be shady, you know, not even on purpose, but just the way that memories are formed and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And like you say, memories take on different shades at different times, depending on what's been going on in your life at the time that you write. I mean, what's interesting about this as an essay collection is obviously it resists, you know, you've just talked about the aspirational aspects of memoir. And, you know, I think there's a pressure, I think, in this particular time and space for queer authors to publish, you know, fairly sort of, if not aspirational stories, then at least kind of feel-good stories.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And I think that's partly a reaction against the fact that in the, you know, within living memory, a lot of queer narratives have been, you know, deeply tragic and, you know, quite traumatizing for queer people growing up. I think any queer person, you know, of my age or of your age will have a story of a film they saw or a book they read in their youth, and just, you know,
you do such a good job in your book of talking about the real effect that has on your psyche.
Well,
that's its own trauma, like having to witness all these like images of your people being traumatized is its own
absolutely.
Trauma.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, even if it's fictional.
Because those, you know, maybe were the only narratives available to you at that point. And there's been a real pressure on the next wave of queer authors, I think, to create something different. But of course, you know, a structure like an essay collection that can sort of resist that sort of structure of building towards a sort of a end that has a kind of a happy end or even just an easy resolution without explicitly rejecting it. And I think
right.
that's interesting.
Yeah, it is cool that you can do that because you can have an essay that is a downer if you want to have a downer, and then you can have an essay that's uplifting. It's like there's so many endings within the book that keeps kind of ending so you can kind of play around.
Well, I'd like to talk about two of the longer essays in the book, which are both in the middle section, which is called Love and Queerness. The book is divided into three sections. There it starts with art and music, where you talk about various things like being a fan of the Welsh goth group, Jean Loves Jezebel.
I don't hear that a lot. So
that's
cool.
Our first sale of the month.
Okay, cool.
You talk about Prince, you talk about the band Minor Threat, the straight edge band with Ian MacKaye, who ended up forming Fugazi. We'll come back to that in a bit. But in the Love and Queerness section, you have two long kind of essays that chart a history of a movement or a group. One of them is on Camp Trans, which was set up in the early 90s in response to a trans woman, Nancy Jean Burkholder, being excluded from the Michigan Women's Music Festival, which was set up during the second wave feminist period. It was a very popular women-only music festival that had a trans exclusionary policy. Mm-hmm. Camp Trans set up, I think, over the road?
Yeah, across the road. It started the year after Nancy Burkholder got kicked out, and she wasn't just excluded, like she was kicked out. She was like not allowed to go. She was like interrogated rudely. She was not allowed to go. She'd already set up her camp. She wasn't allowed to go back to her camp, get her stuff. Her friends who were on their way never knew didn't know what happened to her until afterwards. So it was it was violent and traumatic. And the next year she came back with she made these pamphlets just trying to educate people about like who trans people are and just kind of flyered the big long line of cars trying to get in. And then from there, it became an encampment every year across the road until it grew so big that it actually had to go down the road. And it became its own thing. And there was a little internal controversy, like was it losing its sight of its focus on, you know, trans women's issues? Was it turning into more of like a party camp as more and more cute trans guys sort of started hooking up with the lesbians across the way? Like, you know, there was like a lot of that happened. But the year that I went, there was a real focus on trans women experience and trans women leadership, and it was really cool. It was a really cool experience, and it's so funny. Somebody had mentioned, I think on this trip actually, about how in talking about the Michigan Women's Music Festival, even though I'm very clearly against the policy, and I was one of the artists that boycotted the festival in response to their refusal to change the policy and stuff, that I was sort of generous about like how amazing it is to be there and what the festival's like. And I was like, oh, because at the time I wrote it, there was still hope that there was a still hope for inclusion. You know, like there was so many people who go to the festival. The festival is not a collective. The festival is a business owned by one woman who made all the rules. So there was like all of this kind of work from the outside and from the inside to try to get trans inclusion. And so it seemed possible. And then instead, she just pulled the plug and let the whole thing die. And just like was like so determined as the festival started to flounder and suffer because people were increasingly boycotting it because they were increasingly upset at this as they learned what was going on. Instead of changing it, she just kind of killed it. So I was like, oh, I was kind of nicer than I felt. But I think the end of it is I got bitchy and mad at the very end in this version for this book because I was like, oh, yeah, I think that's why I was a little...
But I mean, that's one of the things I kind of like most about the book is that, you know, you do take this quite generous and quite nuanced approach to the subjects you write about. The first essay is on Valerie Solanas, author of The Scum Manifesto. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for people who are... I imagine a lot of people in this audience will be familiar with Solanas and the Scum Manifesto, but we'll unpack that a bit in a minute. But you're very, you know, you're very generous to Solanas, even as you acknowledge and write about the controversy it's caused within like gay male circles and the resentment from those corners, the way some like trans women feel about Solanas, and you know, this sort of second wave feminist movement that Solanas, I don't think, was really hugely involved with, but was kind of on the fringes of.
She was happening at the same time, but like they had nothing to do, really to do with her.
So maybe if you'd like to talk a bit about the Scum Manifesto, what it was, why you wrote about it, and, you know, how you kind of navigated writing about such a controversial and kind of thorny text.
Uh-huh. Well, the Scum Manifesto, it's the Society for Cutting Up Men, and it's this insane work of literature, and it's everything. It's a manifesto, it's satire, it's a joke with more than a nugget of truth at the center of it. It's punk before there was punk. It's really wild. And Valerie Solanas was a total outsider. You know, she was a survivor. She was a sex worker. She was gender variant herself. She was like, you know, gender nonconforming, without real language for that at that point. She was really broke. She like lived in SRO hotels. And she was an artist. And she was so outside of the culture that she could write something that was so outrageous, that was talking about how the world would be better without men and they should all be murdered, you know? And it's funny and it's not, you know? And I just, when I remember reading it, I just thought it was so outrageous. And she makes so many good points. I mean, and I talk about this. I wrote about her because I was actually asked to write the intro to a new version of the Scum Manifesto, which is the best thing that's ever happened to me in my entire life. Like, that was so cool. But she, there's so much in it about class. It's like, you know, she's like, yes, all men should be, you know, killed or whatever. But also we have to like make transportation free, you know, and like,
the first thing she says is abolish the money system.
Abolish the money system, yeah. And like, automate all the boring jobs so that like scum chicks can be groovy and hang out with, I mean, it's wild. And you're like, I don't know how you can read it and not be like, yes, crazy freak. Yes. You know, it's funny. And I just think like, oh my God, the culture, how many women get murdered? I mean, for real, it's like, it's entertainment. And it's like, one person writes a fucking book about killing men and it's like, everyone is so upset. And I just think it's so hypocritical and it's so ignorant, honestly. And I do have compassion for, what happened, and I write about this a little bit, is that somebody, I ran a nonprofit in San Francisco that did literary events, and Valerie Solanas died in San Francisco, and where she had been a sex worker and was living in like an SRO hotel in the Tenderloin. And you know, at the time she died from like pneumonia or something sad, like she was just in really poor health. And now there is the St. James Infirmary in the Tenderloin, which is a clinic specifically for sex workers and gender variant people. And it's really cool. So they do awesome work. So we were going to do, somebody was like, why don't you do something for the anniversary? It's like the 25th anniversary of Valerie's having died here. Why don't we you should do an event. And I was like, okay, cool. And I was exhausted. I just came back from a tour, but I was like, anything for Valerie. And so I put it together, and it was going to be, we just did all this funny stuff where it was going to be like $3 for people who identify as women and $10 for everybody else. And, you know, or whatever, people who identify as men. And I don't know, we were like fucking around with just ways to kind of be cheeky with, Valerie's message. Like there's a thing in it where she says that men who take this vow and say, I am a turd, a lowly turd, and like say take this vow and cop to being a turd, will be sort of like allowed to hang out with groovy scum women. Like, it's so funny. And so I had gotten all of these like cisgendered poets that I know to like agree to come and do the I am a turd, a lowly turd. And I invited a lot of different, a good kind of intersectional group of people to come. And I had no expectation of what anyone would do. Like, they could just talk about how they hate Valerie Solanas, how they love Valerie Solanas, read from the work, don't, you know, I wanted it to be an exploration of the legacy that she created, this crazy piece of art that's still polarizing and controversial and kind of electric and really unlike any other piece of writing. But it got so like, oh, the internet, you know, the internet killed the event because people just started fighting about it. And all of these like gay men were like, it's like Jim Jones. And I'm like, oh, not Jim Jones. It's like, who's the dude who shot Harvey Milk? And I was like, no, it's not.
Dan White,
like, yeah. Yeah, Dan White. It's like, this is like Dan White. Like, you're celebrating Dan White. I'm like, you know, it's like, I don't like are getting into these arguments with people who are so dumb and that who are like I don't, because I just feel so stumped. I'm like, if you think that Valerie Solanas is the same as Dan White, like, I can't talk to you. Like, I don't, because I'm just like, my mind is spinning. I don't know where to start. And I get triggered because it makes me feel like I'm 14 again and I'm trying to explain to my parents, like, why they shouldn't be racist. You know what I mean? And no one's listening to me and people are scoffing. It's just like, it's too much. I can't do it anymore. So I was like, oh, Jesus. And then there were a lot of trans women who were grouping her in with TERFs, you know? And I don't want to tell a trans woman as a cisgendered person, like, who is there, who, you know, who anyone feels like their enemy is or not. but I didn't want to, like, I see Valerie as a gender variant person herself who was not part of that world. And we had a lot of mental health issues and just like, I don't know, like had so much more, I feel like, kinship with trans people than being a turfy feminist. I mean, those feminists from like radical women in New York City at the time, like they wanted nothing to do with her. Like they thought she was kind of crazy. When she got arrested, I think some of them kind of showed up for her to try to bail her out.
This was when she shot Andy Warhol. After she shot Andy Warhol. Yeah.
Yes, after she did that. But something about that too is like, I just want, you know, I just want to paint the picture. I know, right? Yeah. Let's paint the picture, okay, though? It's like the 60s. Shit is ugly. It's ugly for women. It's like, is it even ugly for queer people? They barely exist. It's like so ugly for queer people, right? And for someone like Valerie, who doesn't have any sort of femme cachet to trade on, like no glamour, like people just thought she was a dyke. She's walking around with a newsy hat. Nobody understood her. She's totally an outsider of the culture. She's, you know, turning tricks. She's living in a hotel. You know, she's a survivor. She's got all of this trauma. And she's this brilliant writer. And she kind of knows maybe that she's a little bit brilliant. She's got a vision. And she writes this piece. And guess who she's hanging out with? Fucking Andy Warhol, the biggest artist of her time. She has proximity to him. Be like somebody, I mean, they're, you know, thinking about who Valerie was then. I mean, there are still so many queer individuals that are just like who Valerie is now, you know? And imagine they're suddenly a proximity to like Kanye West or something. I don't know, you know? It's like the biggest artist of your generation is within reach and they could change your life and they could get your play produced, you know? And there's no internet and you have like one fucking copy of your play that you work so hard on and really believe in and you bring it to this huge artist and they like condescendingly comment on how you seem to be a really good typer and you should come and type for him and then that's it. And then you contact him a million times to get your goddamn playback and he doesn't even have the time to give you your playback.
Well, he lost it, I think.
No, it's in his archives at the museum. Okay. There's the Andy Warhol Museum, which is, and for the record, I fucking love Andy Warhol. I do, and I get the complications of all of it. But like, I just think, oh my God, this is an unhinged and desperate person. And there was so much going on. There was so much misogyny and transphobia and there, you know, classism and stigma against mental health and sex, just everything was working against Valerie, you know? And he should have just given her back her play and he wouldn't have got shot. I mean, I don't think he deserved to get shot. Nobody deserves to have an act of violence, you know, violence enacted upon them. But just think, it would be so different if he had just given her back her fucking play, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've got manuscripts with a few publishers at the moment.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Anyway, everyone got so upset about the stupid Valerie Solana show in San Francisco that I was like, this is why we can't have nice things. I cancel it. So I canceled the show. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, Valerie Solana is somebody who, you know, for all the frustrations, difficulties she was working with, you know, posterity has, you know, recorded.
Yes.
The longest text in Against Memoir is on a group called the Hags, mm-hmm. Who were a sort of queer and dyke street group in mm-hmm. the 1990s who, you know, had some sort of cultural expression through music and zines and things. But, you know, there's a real determination in this long essay about the Hags to, you know, record their lives and them as individuals mm-hmm. for fear of them being lost. You, at one point in the book, you quote Sarah Shulman, who wrote Gentrification of the Mind. And Shulman, you know, elsewhere, I've seen her talk quite interestingly. The performance artist Penny Arcade talks about this as well. The way that, you know, when, in particular, when the HIV and AIDS crisis hit in the 80s, in queer circles before, there'd been this sort of just this kind of oral history tradition. People kind of found their queer families. Mm-hmm. And these stories were handed down just orally. And of course, the HIV and AIDS crisis, you know, created this huge kind of, well, this almost like firewall in that mm-hmm. in that process. And so there became a need to write these histories down because otherwise they would be lost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a similar thing happens with the Hags, partly because a lot of them are addicts and they become ill as a result of their addiction. But I'd like you to maybe tell the audience a bit more of that story, why you recorded it.
Mm-hmm. The Hags started, basically there was this one dagger, Tracy Thomas, she was getting over a breakup and just like wanted to act out and be crazy. And she's like, let's have a gang, you know? And it was kind of a lark. And she named it the Hags after John Waters' short film, Hag in a Black Leather Jacket. And it was kind of more campy than anything for her. And then I guess guess, you know, it was really just like queers finding each other and hanging out and then being like, we're a gang, you know, but it became very real. And Tracy moved away and the people who were hags just started bringing their own people into the gang, and Tracy was trying to control it, and they called her Scramma, and they're like, yeah, we need Scramma's, you know, approval before we let you in. And she would be like, no, they can't be a hag. And the people who were back in San Francisco were just like, fuck it, and kind of took over. And when I was in San Francisco, I would see the hags. I would see them out on the street. I would see them at music shows, at punk shows, and they were so hot. And I'd never seen people like this before because they were gender variant and they were fucking punk and just tattooed and pierced with crazy hair and like they fucking clearly didn't care and they were metal and super scary, and I knew they did really hard drugs, and I was so attracted and scared by them, and I was like, what do I have to do to date them? I was like, probably it would be bad for me, whatever I would have to do. But I really respected them. I thought they were like warriors. I thought they were like the embodiment of like a fuck you, you know? And I thought they were the people who were truly on the margins. Like, they didn't have allegiance to anyone. Like, I had a friend who, like, was sleeping with a couple who were hag adjacent, and then they got like, I don't know, they had a falling out, and she was just like, I have to go meet Patty and Rena in the park and fight them. And I'm like, wait, what? You don't fight people. She's like, that's just their code, you know, I gotta fight one of them. And I was like, this is fucking crazy. So like, they were wild, and they were living by their own code. They did petty crimes, they did too much drugs, they drugged themselves into occasional psychoses. They and I just thought they were amazing. And it was really like, you know, one of them that I interviewed, Becky, was like, I had said something about Riot Girl, and she was like, we ate Riot Girls for breakfast. Like, they had no allegiance to anything because they were outside of all of it. Even what, you know, to me, like I guess what, you know, like radical feminism was for me was like Riot Girl, and they just were like, no, you know. And I was like, God, these people are amazing. They're just like so, they're creating their own everything. So I really admired them and thought they were incredible. And I was never very close to any of them, but I have friends. We had a lot of mutual friends. I'm closer to them, some of them now, than I was then. But yeah, their drug use got really out of control. And you know, these are people who had a ton of trauma. I mean, there was no support for, I mean, basically I think that the majority of the hags were trans, but it was before that was a consciousness, and nobody had that consciousness about them. I mean, they identified as a dyke gang, like they identified as dykes, but most of the people who are still alive, because a bunch of them died from drugs, have transitioned and are like men and male identified. So, and I think it's safe to assume that a lot of the folks who passed away, that was probably their story as well, had they lived to sort of understand themselves and move with the culture. But yeah, I mean, and they were from really, you know, bad homes. They were all fleeing abusive families in America. They'd all come to San Francisco and found each other. And they were trying to survive. And they, you know, they were addicts. And that addiction became sort of, initially was a sort of like middle finger, you know, just being like, I'll do what I want. And the way that I think a lot of like drugs, when they're embraced by counterculture, kind of, I don't know, like there's that feeling where you're just like, fuck you, you're not the boss of me. But you know, they got real addictions, and they got, a bunch of them got really sick, and some died. And it was very sobering, and it was a really dark moment in like my queer community when that happened, just to think that the consequences could be so, so dark. And they were so young and beautiful. And it's like, in researching the book, just like I think they were all a little older than me at the time. So I kind of, even in writing about them, I felt like I was like looking up at them. And then I found their pictures, you know, and I was like, oh my God, they're fucking babies. Like babies abandoned in the wild, like so many fucking queer, young queer people, you know, doing their best with a culture that was like, you're a monster. And them just being, fuck you, I'm going to be like the best monster then, you know? So yeah, I just have always been haunted by them and wanted to tell their story. So
yeah, and I mean, that certainly comes across in the essay. You know, you're obviously, you know, very personally and politically driven to you know, record that story and stop it being lost. You know, later in the book, you talk about, and this is something that really resonated with me, you talk about really not feeling very comfortable, disliking being called an activist because of your writing. And I wondered if you'd maybe like to, you know, unpack that a bit.
Let's unpack it. Yeah, I mean, I feel like my writing is activist adjacent. I think my writing could be enjoyed by activists, but I don't think it is of it in and of itself activism. I feel like, you know, I'm not setting out necessarily to change things in my writing. Like, I want everything to change, and if it has a part in that, the way that literature sometimes can, that's beautiful. But I'm really setting out to satisfy an artistic desire. So it doesn't feel, to call it activism, it would feel a little bit like I was putting on an air, because I have so much respect for activists, and I've done actual activism, and you're out in the street and it's really hard work, and you get burnout, and it's, you don't get invited to speak to an audience of adorable people in London on a lovely evening. You know what I mean? It's, I mean, maybe you do, I don't know, but I didn't when I was an activist. So yeah, I mean, I feel like the Camp Trans piece, because I did feel like there was a possibility that that piece could actually enact actual change, that felt a little more activist-y to me, and that felt really nice. You know, I think it's tricky for people who are artists who also have deep social justice convictions, because it's like you, that balance, you know, if like you tip too much on the social justice balance, it's like not necessarily art, it's propaganda. Even if it's propaganda that everyone likes and agrees with, it's not necessarily artful. And, you know, I want to be an artist in that I want people to be able to get lost in the artfulness of the work that I'm doing, you know. I don't feel like it's activism, but if you insist, I won't fight you on it.
Maybe you could adopt as a slogan something like, not activist, but number one with activists.
Beloved by activists. Activist adjacent.
Something that, one of the essays that I found the most touching, and maybe this would be a good moment for a reading, is an essay called The City to a Young Girl, where you talk about reading a poem written by a 15-year-old New York schoolgirl called Jodi Caravaglia. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you talk about sort of being so moved by this poem that you sort of, you track her down. Mm-hmm. So maybe you'd like to talk a bit more about that, and maybe give us a bit of the bit of the text here.
Just to kind of place you in the essay where I'm jumping in, is that I was asked right after the election in the U.S. to go speak at a university in Portland, Oregon, and they wanted me to speak on writing as activism, which, as you just saw, I'm very like about it to begin with. But then I really just felt so depressed after the election. I was like, oh, writing is activism? Are you fucking kidding? Like, we need, like, I don't know, Molotov cocktails is activism, you know? So, and I also felt like this expectation, like I kind of understand enough about like my temperament and my work in the world that I was like, oh, they're bringing me there to fucking cheer everybody up and be like, it's cool guys, we're gonna fix the problem. And I didn't feel like that. And it was right after, it wasn't after the election. It was after the Access Hollywood tapes came out, where Trump was saying like the whole grab them by the pussy thing. And it was clear that nobody cared that he said that. And it was so depressing. That's what was so depressing. And I grew up in a really crappy town in Massachusetts, where we had a mayor who was a flasher, who liked to just like whip his dick out at people. And did other things I learned afterwards too. It was just sort of like sexually compulsive and inappropriate and abusive. So, but he had this whole career. So I was going to write about him and write about this, a very uplifting thing about how men can basically do anything and still get elected to office. And I was trying to find what his name was, this mayor. And what I found is that after he was the mayor, he did destroy his political career by doing, you know, there were some consequences for him, but he wound up being the chair of the school board in Chelsea, Massachusetts in the 70s. And he ended up banning a poem, and there was this whole thing that happened, a whole federal lawsuit happened as a result of this guy banning a poem. And so here's the poem. It's called The City to a Young Girl. And I found it while researching this guy. The city is 1 million horny, lip-smacking men screaming for my body. The streets are long conveyor belts loaded with these suckling pigs, all begging for a lay, a little pussy, a bit of tit, a leg to rub against, a handful of ass. The connoisseurs of cunt every day, every night, pressing in on me closer and closer. I swat them off like flies, but they keep coming back. I'm a good piece of meat. This poem was written in 1970 by a 15-year-old New York City girl named Jodi Caravaglia. It had been published in the Hunter College High School Literary Magazine, and from there was picked up for inclusion in an Avon anthology with the scintillating title Male and Female Under 18. 40,000 copies of this collection of youth writing were published, and the book was selected by educational publishers Prentice Hall for inclusion in a reading program, which bundled together a variety of books and sold them to school libraries at a discount. Chelsea High School's library participated in this program, and in winter 1976, male and female under 18 was added to the shelves. That spring, an upset parent made a phone call to Andrew Quigley, the flasher, the chair of the school committee. Her teenage daughter, it was his teenage daughter, it was a guy. I learned so much more after I wrote this, actually. Had borrowed male and female, and maybe she was freaked out by the city to a young girl, the shock of finding the word cunt in a school library book. Or maybe a parent was paging through it, and it was them who flipped out. Regardless, Quigley made a home visit and was shown the poem and decided the book would be removed from the library. He didn't consult the rest of the committee, three men and three women, but did arrange a meeting to discuss, quote, objectionable, salacious, and obscene material being made available in books in the high school library. He also happened to own the local paper, which he used the op-ed column the way that Trump uses Twitter. So he then penned an op-ed and published it in his newspaper. Male and female under 18 made me sick to my stomach to think that such a book could be obtained in any school, let alone one here in Chelsea. So, and then I went on to find, I got immediately obsessed with Jodi Caravaglia. Who is this girl who wrote this slam poem before there were slam poems? You know, it was like super punk before there was punk. So I started Google searching her, and then I found all these photographs of like Patti Smith and like Elvis Costello with her photo, her as the photo credit. And then I kept looking, and then I found that there was a Jodi Caravaglia in Brooklyn doing prenatal massage, and there was just a phone number. So I called her, I left a message. I was in a cafe. It was 2 hours before I was supposed to speak at this school in Portland, and I still didn't know what the hell I was going to talk about. I went and got a coffee, and my phone rang, and it was Jodi Caravaglia. She was so great. I was like, I told her I'd like to be her friend. I don't do friends, she says, in a not unfriendly way, but we can know each other. I have to ask, what sign are you? Scorpio. And so, she was a little suspicious. She was like, why are you calling me about this guy? You know, this happened to her so long ago. And we became wonderful friends, and I've like stayed at her house now. We are friends. And I ended up, it was a really tremendous thing. What happened is that the school committee, basically this guy bullied everybody, like didn't even show the poem, wouldn't show the poem to the female members of the school committee because it was too... he was like, you're too young. They're like in their 50s. I've read all the notes now. I've like took such a deep dive into this. And they just pulled it. And you just actually can't do that. That's censorship, you know, in a high school library, still a library. And it was a public high school. And so a librarian actually, the high school librarian fought him and took it all the way to federal court in Boston. Yeah. And man, does she look like a lesbian in the pictures. She just does. She looks like a leser from the 70s. And I can't find her. I found so many other people who were involved. She gathered people, people supported her. They formed a Right to Read committee. She got this great, the ACLU gave her a lawyer. The lawyer had worked on Muhammad Ali's case against the Supreme Court for not being in the Vietnam War. He was amazing. Their judge happened to be the judge that also voted, decades later on the Edie Windsor case in Massachusetts, which became the first gay marriage league, in the United States, and paved the way for all gay marriage in the United States. So there was like, the more I learned, there was all these ties to all these other really interesting things. But yeah, they won. And it was this amazing thing. Chelsea's really working class, really kind of broke, rough city. And, the way that this guy, Andrew Quigley, talked about the people of Chelsea was very much the way that Trump talks about, like, the working people, but it's such bullshit. It's just, like, political and just trying to fan flames. And what was cool is that a lot of people didn't like anybody telling them what to do. Like, there's that kind of temperament to the city also. It's like, don't tell me what I can do. I'll make up my own mind. So the week that it went on trial, all these kids from Chelsea High School went to the trial. And there's all this great transcript of like the judge being like, no throwing your gum on the carpet, and people are like throwing toilet paper out the window or something. Like everyone's just like acting like a hoodlum, but also witnessing like, the law and all this cool stuff. So yeah, I'm writing a screenplay about it. I'm really interested in it. I don't know it's like a library banned poem case. It might be too nerdy for Hollywood. I don't know. But it's been very, it's been really fun for me to know that like this fight kind of came out of my hometown, which is definitely a shithole. So it's like one good thing that came out of it.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Great. Well, I think that's maybe a nice point to go to the audience.
So yeah, I'm a queer person in recovery as well, and I really loved your book, How to Grow Up, and I recommend it to anyone that's new in recovery because I just think it's very hopeful.
Aww.
But I think, like for me, recovery is just about telling your story like over and over and over again, basically.
Yeah.
And you know, and different versions. But I think sometimes you know I can tell the beginning, the middle, and the end. And it, you can become a bit dissociated from it, really, because like the longer you're sober, the more in the past it seems, and the more you can't really identify with that person at all that was doing that stuff.
Yeah.
And I just wondered like what you thought about that and how that's influenced your kind of storytelling and memoir.
That's so interesting. So yeah, I'm also in recovery, and you tell, you know, part of recovery is you share your story for your own benefit and for other people to hear, you know, that they're not alone when they poop to themselves and whatnot. I don't know. I mean, I totally know what you mean. You can become dissociated. I think that at this point I have like 16 years sober. So when I do tell my story, it's often about like what it's like for me today to be a person in recovery and a sober person. And it's not always about like, you know, my drunken misadventures or what got me sober. So I think that having like a recovery program that's really alive actually helps me just stay connected to the fact that, you know, I'm an alcoholic today. And like, basically for me, it's like anytime I think I have a problem, it's usually just alcoholism. It's just like manifesting in another way, you know? And so just to think about it like that, and that, let it become detached from the actual drinking of 16 years ago, and let it be more about sort of the weird mental landscape of today, you know, if that makes sense. Congratulations. It's like really life-changing.
When you were talking about the compulsion of memoir, it really reminded me of how we use social media, and you touched on it a little bit in Against Memoir.
Uh-huh.
And I just kind of wanted to know maybe more your thoughts about like how especially people our generation kind of use social media as a compulsive memoir, but it's like I feel like it's definitely more negative than writing it down and being able to leave it and not be exposed to people 10 years later when you're a different person.
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's, I wouldn't say that social media or that impulse is exactly the same as memoir, because there is, in memoir, you're talking about your experience, but ideally you're also talking about like the pattern of light falling across the wall, and you're talking about the smell in the air. I mean, you really are trying to create something that is larger, that holds your story, but it's also larger than your story, you know, and there's an art and a craft in it that I don't think there's necessarily an art. There's not the space for an art and a craft necessarily in social media. Even if somebody was aspiring towards that, I think it wouldn't really work. There is, I wrote about this, that I learned that we get dopamine from talking about ourselves, you know, we get dopamine. And it's kind of beautiful in a way, because if you think about it like evolutionarily, like we're supposed to share ourselves with each other and share our stories with each other. And I think that that's an impulse that can go a little haywire, I guess, with the internet, you know. My partner gets a lot of dopamine from posting pictures of themselves on Instagram. Like they just do, they're like, oh, I posted a picture on Instagram. And I'm just like, oh my God, like I don't get that. I do get dopamine from my phone. I do have a body. I'm like everybody else, I'm addicted to it. I get dopamine from just like other like messages or texts or something like that. Like, who texted me? Is there an opportunity coming? You know, but I don't know. I think that we're just human, you know, and it's like, these sort of addictive tendencies, of course, we don't need to be on social media, but if you want to participate in your place and your time, you probably do want to be to some degree on social media. So there's some things that you can be. My perspective on addiction is that, like, if anything that gives you dopamine, you can become addicted to. That's what I think, you know? And I didn't really understand that before I kind of got sober, and I thought that people who talked about shopping addictions were crazy, and people who talked about sex addictions were fucking bummers, and, like, I didn't get it, you know? And now I just understand that you can use anything to sort of get away from yourself, you know, and disconnect from yourself and put it all into something else, you know? And I think that it can be really complicated when what you have addictive tendencies to are things that we do want or need in our life, like sex or love or shopping or food or the internet. So I think it just, you know, it's easier almost with alcohol, where you can be like, I can just stop drinking alcohol. Everything's fine. There's lots of things to drink, you know, but I do want to have sex, you know, and I do want to buy pants sometimes, you know, and so trying to figure out how to regulate that can be really, really challenging.
What do you think would have been Valerie Solanas's social network of choice?
Oh my God! What a great question. Valerie Solanas on Instagram, right?
Keep her off Twitter, I think.
But, yeah. She'd be on Twitter, you're so fucking right. Oh my God, Twitter.
You
yeah.
Too.
You think, oh, okay. Oh my God.
I think Tumblr and then she'd have migrated to Twitter, I think.
Valerie Solanas on Tumblr.
One of the Tumblr teens of the early 2010s. And then, anyway.
Valerie Solanas on LiveJournal.
Oh, yeah, I would read the fuck out of
yeah.
that.
Yeah, totally. Oh, man.
All right, next question.
Hey, Michelle.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going? I wanted to ask if you had any advice for a budding memoirist on how to deal with the issue of presenting real life people in your life, mm-hmm. and whose role has been perhaps negative.
Sure. Well, I think that my advice would be just write the memoir and don't think about it. Do not think about it. Just write your story, write your first draft, and then when you're done, you have a work to work with, and then you can look at it and be like, is that too much? Is that person, am I going to be uncomfortable? Can I remove this and still keep the heart of the story and the heart of what I want to say? Or I don't fucking care, you know, or whatever I think that it can really, that kind of the fears that are associated with that can actually just like stop your writing in its tracks, and you just don't want to let it do that. So for me, I think that, you know, there's creative writing and then there's editing, and they're two separate things. And when I'm sitting down to write, I don't care if my punctuation sucks. I don't want to overthink it. Like if I use a word and I'm like, that word's dumb, and I'm like, it's fine, it's a placeholder. If I think it's dumb now, I'll think it's dumb later. When I come back to edit, I'll fix it then. You just want to barf out as much text as you can without your rational brain getting in and tinkering. And so I feel like that those kind of questions that are, I don't know, ethical or emotional or whatever they are, they're the property of the rational brain. So don't even worry about it until you got your first draft, and then you can tinker and see if you can mask things or you know, decide that you don't want to.
Can I weigh in on that as well? I mean, in my memoir, I had to obviously write about a lot of people who are still alive. You know, this is the problem with writing a memoir when you're in your early 30s, is, you know, you don't have that safety. And obviously the most difficult people to write about are my parents. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the time I felt really weighed down by worrying about how my parents are going to react to what I'd written about them. I'd already like come out to them as transsexual, and like we'd had to like manage that, and that was hard work. And then I'd written this like Guardian series, so I'd sort of, you know, just gone through the whole process again and tried not to alienate them. And my mum used to comment on the Guardian articles, which is kind of weird.
She'd comment on the website, like,
yeah, it was like being called in for your dinner in front of like thousands of people.
No.
She never read The Guardian before.
That's so awful.
She doesn't even like The Guardian. I mean, neither do I anymore, but for sort of different reasons. But and then went through this process again for this memoir. And, you know, again, sort of, you know, this thing was really weighing on my mind before I kind of started the draft. And I decided in the end, as Michelle says, to do the draft. And then I was like, okay, so I know which bits of the narrative my parents come into, how they fit into the story, which bits I would be prepared to compromise on, which things I might be prepared to take out, which bits would really need to stay in the narrative. And then I could think, okay, well, how do I concretely sit my parents down and talk to them about what's in this book? And so having got that draft down, I decided to work backwards, because sort of towards the end of the book, you know, you get a resolution with my parents and things are kind of nice. So started at that point and then sort of worked back to being like, yeah, and then we have to go back to something you did when I was 12 that I wasn't very happy about. But, you know, because I was sort of so confidently able to sort of and calmly able to explain the narrative and why I'd said these things and the conclusion it reaches, it worked basically. They were kind of happy enough for me to, you know, they didn't ask me to take anything out of the book. There was a very stressful moment when I'd given my parents the proof, and my dad just said, "Oh, I've read the proof that you gave me," and I was just, you know, my heart was kind of in my mouth, and I was like, "Oh God, what did you think?" And there was a long, long pause, and my dad said, "Well, there's a typo on page 74." The other thing I did was take a bit of advice from The Simpsons, which was do it after a big meal because they're so full of food that I don't care what you tell them. So yeah, learn from Michelle, learn from The Simpsons. That's all I can, all I can add.
Yeah, I've been thinking lately about books as kind of boundaries between people that can be really useful in kind of slowing things down a little bit. And just the way you're referring to the space of, you know, that you take a space of writing and you can return to it, whereas the speed of social media is such that you say something and either you delete it when you think better of it, or you know this kind of spontaneity of it can be really it can be really exciting, but it can also be really like overexposing. And the thing about your mom commenting on Guardian things, like my mom, I didn't even know she was on Instagram one time, and she liked something I posted, and I was like, "What? Wait, what? Who is this? Oh, it's my mom." And then, but space. And I wonder also about I'm just finding this current moment really depressing. Like, I'm excited to hear you talk, but just like the Trump thing, the situation we have here, and like who has that space and who can move at all to find a space. And it's, yeah, but I don't know, maybe not get too bleak and talk about a space of writing.
The space of writing?
Yeah,
I don't think that writing is going to save us, you know. I mean, I think that maybe it's a piece of what could save us if we're meant to be saved, you know? I actually have a pretty nihilistic view of things in spite of just having I have a 4-year-old and I'm like, oh, you can't be nihilistic. You fucking selfishly brought a life onto this dying planet, you know? But yeah, I think we're all, you know, feeling shades of that for sure, of what you're feeling. You're certainly not alone. And I don't have any answers, you know. I don't understand what happened. I do understand what happens. Like, there's like fascism, you know. There's like, it's like an easy out for a lot of scared people. And it's, I don't know, I could get very dark. But I'm with you. I think I have no answers. I'm sorry. I'm sorry we're in such a dark time. We really are. But, you know, I'm taking what I think is cool that has happened, at least in the States, there is the response has been like, oh, really? Oh, fuck. Okay. Zero tolerance. Zero tolerance for misogyny. Zero tolerance for racism. Zero tolerance for transphobia. Like, just like promoting people who, you know, like promoting intersectionalism, really taking a look at like, how did this fucking happen? And, you know, obviously it's not like the queer left feminist world that brought this upon us, but so much soul searching, and I think in a way that's really cool. And so I don't know how the same country that elected Obama then elected. I mean, everyone's fucking baffled by that, except he didn't get the popular vote in the States. So I also, we have this archaic from like that's somehow associated with slavery, this like electoral college bullshit. So I console myself with that most people did not want him to be the president.
I just want to talk about this kind of doom and how in Black Wave, which is your novel that you published or that We and other stories published. Sorry, not doing a promotional thing here, but this is relevant.
This is my
promise.
Publicist.
it's relevant. I promise. One way that people escape the sort of horror of the impending ending of the world is that they start to find other people, and they find them in their dreams. Mm-hmm. And can you tell us about that? Because I think it's just the most beautiful way of kind of coming to terms with the possibility of endings and how you live with them.
Yeah, thank you. In Black Wave, the world is, it's the 90s, but the world is ending. So it's like an alternate 90s reality. And something, once the world begins to sort of end in earnest, this kind of weird magical thing starts happening where people start having dreams of the people they would have fallen in love with had the world not ended, and had they been able to live out their natural lives. And then on the internet, people start trying to find each other. There's like these message boards about dreams, and then people find each other. And I honestly don't know why I thought of that or where it came from, except, I don't know. That book was so strange because it was meant to be so many other books, and I kept changing it and ripping pieces out and then letting it get weirder and weirder and weirder. But I do remember, like, at the time, that time period that I was writing about, my partner at the time was transitioning, and there, it was the very beginning of when trans men were just making videos of themselves, you know, and putting them online and talking about, like, top surgery or just, like, who they are, or, like, this is, you know, my first month on T or whatever. And so those videos were constantly on, at that time. And so there was just something about these, you know, people finding each other and kind of, like, finding their dream selves, you know, in each other. So I think it was sort of in a weird, vague, roundabout way influenced by that sort of internet phenomena that was happening right then that was so important. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's like, oh my God, you guys, I'm going to get so woo-woo if I go down this path. I just don't even know if you're with me or not.
But let's see if they come with us. I think we've had an hour to earn everyone's trust. So, right.
I just think that life is really huge and mysterious, and we don't know why we're here, and we don't know the point of anything. And I think that it's our duty to fight for the planet and to fight for each other, and we might lose. And if so, that might be what was supposed to happen. And I guess, you know, it's hard to take action when you feel nihilistic, and I think it's our job to take action. So it's hard to balance this. I guess I'm not nihilistic. I'm more realistic, or I don't know what I am, but I just think that I just don't know what will happen, and I don't know what is supposed to happen. I do know I'm supposed to join up with other people and try to make this better and more comfortable place for everybody while we're all here, you know, and climate change is making the earth really uncomfortable and painful for people to live. And so it's our duty to help each other and help the planet. But yeah, I mean, sometimes I just think everything on this planet dies. So maybe the planet is supposed to die. I don't know, you know, but I don't like saying that because I feel like it could be interpreted in the wrong way. Like, fuck it, you know, like single use plastic forever, you know, but whereas I just feel like, I don't know. I mean, I feel like my personal spiritual practice is a lot about like, I don't know, you know, and that things that appear negative to me when they happen in my life, like, I don't know what things are supposed to, like, there's, I think left to our own devices, we just are striving for happiness all the time, which is normal and fine. But I think that that's not necessarily the point of our lives. And sometimes when, you know, you strive for happiness and something fucked up happens, like that might be more what is going to lead to some other kind of thing. I don't know. Does that make sense? It's like very, very, yeah.
I sort of, I don't know. Do we want to add to that? Are there any more questions? We've got time for one or two more, maybe.
Oh my God, hi.
Hello.
Oh my God, my old roommate from the 90s. I'm so sorry.
Why?
Just, you know.
No, so much.
For everything. For everything, Lucy. I'm so sorry.
We were assholes. But we did
we
it so majestically.
Yeah.
We were really good at it.
Yeah.
It was, but and it's kind of because, I mean, it was amazing reading that book. Because it sat in our apartment, like when I lived there, yeah. And it was like crawling through. It's so good. It's very. But I think that's really super. I don't have a question, except I just wanted to say something. Also, just get your attention.
Yeah.
Hi. but I did think it's worth saying that you're talking about memoir and you're talking about your experience, but it's so acute
the observation, like reading it was crazy. Like it took me back to 20 years ago. Yeah. And while we were living there, I was making a documentary, mm-hmm. which I erased myself from. Mm-hmm. I was trying to do objective in a way. I don't know, I was also going, you know, my own whatever. Uh-huh. But there's something, if you put yourself in it, but with genuine curiosity and interest, uh-huh. then you're saying something more general, which could then be political, which is more clear in maybe Sarah Shulman or Rebecca Solnit, mm-hmm. those people who work between their lived experience and observation. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm just rambling. But it is just, there's just something really important in being really acknowledging your presence, but really looking at what you're around. Mm-hmm. Question mark. Hi.
Hi. Oh, am I supposed to comment on that? I don't know. I'm glad that it worked. You know, my writing process is very subconscious, and I definitely never set out to make a particular point, you know, but at the same time, I have lots of opinions, and I think about things really obsessively, so it's not a surprise that the things that come out, but I just don't have a map when I sit down to write. I have a vague idea of where I want to go, and so I'm glad that it all comes together.
It's just that you care about what's going on and you're looking.
Yeah. Really, oh, yeah, absolutely.
I just wanted to highlight that because I think it matters.
Oh. Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
Well, that feels to me like a nice place to draw the conversation to a close. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.